89.
Graham Session, recording number 21, September 30th, 2012. They're coming to take me away. They're coming to take me away. Oh, this is great. This is just great, great, great. You're out there somewhere, aren't you? Ladies and gentlemen of the FBI. What did it? I really want to know. I really do. What did it? How did you pin me down to that football game? Oh, shit. Fuck. Fuck. How the... What the... You think you're going to take me alive? Is that what you think, you miserable, stupid fuck shit? Fuck, fuck, fuck. You're going to lock me up and study me like a caged rat and strap me down and analyze my brainwaves so you can stop the next one like me? Oh, that's rich. That's the plum jewel of the whole thing right there, thinking that you can ever stop someone like me. You can't. Don't you see that? Don't you understand? You can't prevent the next one like me, because the next me is you. I'm inside all of you. The only difference is I don't hide behind some mask driving my SUV and sipping Starbucks at my kids' soccer game. You're just like me, and you don't even know it. You hear me? Do you fucking hear me? Why should I let you take me alive, huh? Why should I? Why should you know anything about me? You don't deserve it. I was trying to help you. I was... Fuck! Fuck! I was trying to get you to understand. But why the hell should I care if any of you understand me? Why should I care about anything anymore? You've done nothing to deserve it. You and the miserable little sheep that follow you haven't done a single thing in life to deserve what I can teach you, what I tried to teach you. So just go on with your little sheep, miserable lives, doing what everyone says and telling yourself that your life is normal and good and happy, and never mind who's pulling all the levers, and never mind what's really going on in the world or who the real people are hiding behind those smiley faces and blow-dried hair and whatever. Whatever. You know what? I'm done with this. But you won't get me alive. You could have learned so much from me, but now it's too late. Why should I give a shit about you when you don't give a shit about me? About me? Why don't I matter? You think you'll stop people like me? You can never do that. Do you hear me, FBI boys and girls? You won't ever, ever stop people like me. Oh, I can't. I don't believe this. I can't believe this. But too bad for you. I won't go quietly. I can't. Don't you see? I just can't. It shouldn't be like this. It shouldn't be like this. This isn't right. This isn't fair. I'm not what you think I am. But you'll never understand. You'll never even try to understand. I'm finished trying to help you understand. I'm done. I'm so tired. I'm so, so tired. I really don't want to do what I have to do now. I really, really, really don't want to do it. I swear to you, I don't. Please believe me, I don't. But I have no choice. She knows too much. And...
90. 4 o'clock in the morning. A deep, still darkness. Not even the first hint of light creeping over the horizon. A peaceful autumn morning in rural Pennsylvania, about to be not so peaceful. The farmhouse belonging to Winston Graham is located in unincorporated Elk County. Surrounded on three sides by acres of scrub brush, former farmland long neglected, with a small forest of trees behind it, the farmhouse is a sprawling brick ranch. The floor plans we've obtained from the county recorder show three bedrooms in the back of the ranch, a kitchen, a living room, and a front parlor. There is a basement as well, spanning the entire floor plan. From the main streets, a long dirt road winds its way for more than a quarter mile to the farmhouse, where Winston Graham's Buick Skylark rests next to the attached garage. Members of the hostage rescue team have crawled into position, surrounding the farmhouse and lying in the weeds, literally, waiting for the signal in their ear from books. They are dressed in black, head to toe, with gas masks and helmets, submachine guns and holstered firearms, stun bombs on their belts. From our perch a quarter mile away on a small hill, I raise the infrared binoculars to my eyes again. There is no movement at the farmhouse. No light inside or outside the house. For all we can tell, the ranch has been abandoned.
"Thank you, Your Honor," says Books into his cell phone.
He lets out a breath of relief.
"We got our warrant."
Books has been on the phone for half an hour with a federal magistrate judge in Pittsburgh, explaining the basis for his probable cause to search the residence of Winston Graham. The last thing we needed after all this work was to have some judge rule the search invalid and leave us with nothing. Books raises his radio to his mouth.
"Team leader, this is Bookman. Do you copy?"
"Copy, Bookman."
The reply through Books's radio breaks the stillness of the night air.
"Team leader, we are now in status yellow."
"Copy that."
"Are you in position, team leader?"
The team leader on the HRT does a quick check with his people around the perimeter before coming back to us.
"We are in position, locked and loaded."
Books looks around at the other agents and me. We are in a small convoy of vehicles out of sight of the farmhouse. The Elk County Sheriff's Office, Pennsylvania State Troopers, the local fire department, the bomb squad, and federal officials from the FBI, as well as the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.
"Team leader,"
says Books.
"We are sending in Kevin. Do you copy?"
"Copy that."
Books nods to the ATF agent standing next to him, a man named Moore. But right now, I'm more interested in the contraption Moore is holding, which includes a video monitor and a toggle stick. He looks like a teenager playing with his Xbox. But Kevin is no video game I've ever seen. Kevin is an explosives detection device, operating like a little remote control truck with tractor wheels and a 360-degree pivot capacity. And we can see what Kevin sees from this remote device. A member of the hostage rescue team approaches an open window. That's odd. Winston Graham is inviting us in. The HRT member lowers Kevin into the living room and scrambles for cover a few yards away. The screen in Moore's hands comes alive. We are now looking inside Winston Graham's house, seeing what Kevin is seeing on a small screen. The living room is filled with antique furniture and a rather small open kitchen. Dated, but lived in, no doubt. A bottle of beer rests on the breakfast counter. Newspapers are strewn about the floor everywhere, almost covering up the hardwood floor. Newspapers. Fires need three things to burn: oxygen, fuel, and heat. The open window is oxygen. The newspapers are fuel. The light on Moore's remote device begins to blink red, a mini siren. Kevin is telling us something. He's telling us that he detects a heat source. "It's gonna blow," I say.
"Team leader, retreat,"
Books calls into his radio.
"Retreat, team."
And then the explosion. A muted blast that interrupts the dark night with a flash of bright orange cascading across the living room, engulfing the room with the snap of a finger, like one fiery dragon's breath.
"Fire team, go, go!"
Books shouts to his right. The fire truck blasts into action, followed by SWAT officers in fire coats and the bomb squad, tires squealing on the paved road.
"He doesn't want to be taken alive,"
says Denny Sasser. I throw on my thick coat and helmet and carry my gas mask in my hand.
"All agents,"
Books cries out as he starts running toward the inferno.
"You keep that perimeter secured. Every inch of that perimeter secured. This could be a diversion." I run along with Books, each of us ignoring the available car and just racing with all our speed toward the house, the beacon of blazing orange and thick smoke blowing through the roof now. The basement! I call out between breaths. He's in the basement! 91.
Stay back!
Books calls out to me, a hand extended as he stands a few yards from the house.
You aren't authorized to enter, Emmy. That's an order!
Tactical agents covered in firefighting gear move in along with the firefighters, acting as armed escorts, their submachine guns drawn and blast shields raised, ready for anything or anyone. Moments later, high-powered hoses do their work on the flames, blowing out the windows in the process, inky black smoke snorting out of every orifice of the ranch. I keep my distance behind a bulletproof shield, awaiting another blast or gunfire or something else, something unexpected, for Mr. Winston Graham has become the expert of the unexpected. Before long, any semblance of fiery orange radiating from the house has disappeared, leaving a drenched, drooping structure still coughing polluted smoke. The fire was precisely planned and well executed, but the fire department was, after all, only a quarter mile away when it started.
Clear!
A voice yells into my earpiece.
Main floor is clear!
Clear of human beings, they mean, dead or alive, and clear of threats. The basement. The fire didn't reach the basement, I'd bet.
Stay here,
Book says to me through his gas mask, turning to me. I take a step back in compliance. He disappears into the black smoke engulfing the house, no longer burning, but radiating a heat so fierce I can feel it through my shield and helmet. Remember your place, I tell myself. Not your place to run in there. You could do more harm than good. You could fall through the floor, and they'd end up spending valuable time saving you. Not your place. I put on the fire boots that go with the rest of my costume, the helmet and shield and gas mask with oxygen tank, the heavy coat and pants. Why did they give me these things if they didn't expect me to go in? I wait 5 minutes, and then I head inside. It's almost impossible to see through the smoke, but I know the layout of the house, just as all the agents do from the floor plans. I suck in clean oxygen off my gas mask while the dirty smog surrounds me. I focus on the floor, partially scalded from the fire, charred bits of newspaper scattered everywhere and floating through the air like remnants of a ticker tape parade. This floor is unsafe to traverse, but I'm not the first or the 10th person to cross it, and I'm not good at patience. I know that if I keep walking straight down the main hallway, past the kitchen and past the bedrooms, the door to the basement will be there. I find the door open, the staircase heading down to the basement free of smoke. I take the steps downward. There are at least 10 agents down there, I tell myself. No matter how good he is, he can't overtake 10 of them. Right? I hit the bottom of the stairs and turn. The main part of the basement is unfinished and dingy, concrete walls and floors. A hot water heater, water softener, washer and dryer in one corner, and a weightlifting bench with barbell and free weights in the other corner. But then there is a long corridor with doors on each side. Agents pull each one open and rush in, weapons first. Shouts of FBI and ATF and federal agents echo back to me. I remove my gas mask and follow down the corridor as agents clear one room after another.
All clear,
shouts one of the agents to Books, who nods and looks around in vain. When he sees me, he lacks the energy to complain. He just shrugs. The entire house, first floor and basement, have been cleared. Where are you, Winston Graham? I walk back into the main area of the basement, the appliances and the workout area. And then I notice the cabinet in the corner, a gray metal structure almost as tall as me, with twin doors and a padlock that is unlocked and hanging over one of the handles. For a man as precise as Winston Graham, that's practically an invitation. Here, I say. Look in here.
Get back, damn it,
Books says, taking my arm and yanking me backward. He gestures with a hurried finger to the cabinet. Agents approach the cabinet on each side. One slips off the padlock. Then, in sync, each agent grabs a handle and yanks open the doors. The interior of the cabinet looks like any other. Three shelves,
two of them completely empty. There is, in fact, only one thing resting on the center shelf. A stack of paper, with a purple bow tied around it.
What the hell is this?
Books asks, approaching the cabinet and looking at the first page of the stack of paper.
What the hell are Graham sessions?
92. Dawn has broken, the sky above us coloring into day, but still it is relatively dark. We are back down the road now, at the back of a SWAT team truck, using the floor of the cabin area as a desk and spreading out the stack of documents, the random musings of a serial killer, which he has dubbed Graham Sessions. They are numbered, 22 in all, and dated. They appear to be recorded orally. He probably used one of those high-tech recorders that automatically transcribe his words into a document. Each Graham session is spread out over the truck's floor. We read them quickly at first. There will be plenty of time for analysis of his word choices and colloquialisms, days that will be spent deconstructing every sentence. But right now, we're looking for any leads on where this monster is hiding. So I pass quickly over the disgusting self-glorification contained in these pages, the revolting passages where we read along as he tortures victims, looking for anything, anything that might give us a clue. Mary, I say aloud. Someone named Mary is mentioned in recording number 12, a conversation with her that he recorded in a bar. And then she keeps coming back in subsequent chapters. She becomes the focus, in fact, with each new passage that I read. He has feelings for her. He is opening up to her. He's becoming tormented over her. He is falling in love with her. Mary is a bartender, a part-time student, a recovering alcoholic. But what is her last name? Where does she live? Are we going to have to search all of Pennsylvania for a woman named Mary? Then we see him melting down as he realizes we're closing in on him. The self-gratification still pops up in spurts, but he's getting nervous. He's losing confidence while trying to convince himself and us that he isn't. What will he do about Mary? We have to find her, I mumble. Books raises a radio to his mouth.
How are we with the cadaver dogs?
They're here, a voice pops back. We're starting with his property and then we'll move to the wooded area behind the ranch. We have agents combing the woods right now.
Let's keep reading, Books says to me. There's got to be some clue about her in there.
But I'm almost done, and there isn't much yet. In recording number 21, dated yesterday, Sunday, after he eluded us at Ford Field, Graham is coming unglued. Good. Fine. But it's his last words on that day that chill me to the bone. She knows too much. He's going to kill her, I say. And then I get to the final recording, dated today, October 1st. 93.
Graham Session, recording number 22, October 1st, 2012. I didn't want this for you, Mary. I didn't want this for us. You have to believe me. Please tell me that much. Tell me that you believe what I'm saying. I've been lying to you. I've been lying to myself, convincing myself that I could be different with you, that everything could be different. But please believe me now. Please believe that if I'd met you earlier, things would have been different. I would have changed. I know I would have. I would have changed for you, Mary. But now, it's too late. And I can't let you. No, Mary, I can't. I'm sorry. I'm sorrier than I've ever been in my life. I've never been sorry before, actually. Never. But I am now. Because you've opened up things inside me. And I wanted to let them out and explore them together with you. I know we could have done that, and everything would have been okay. Please understand, Mary. Please. That I have no choice. I have no choice but to do this, because no matter how much you might love me back, they'll turn you and make you tell them things about me, and I can't let them do that to you. If I could leave you here, I would. But I can't. I don't have a choice. You see that, don't you? I don't have a choice. It's outside my control. They're coming for me now, Mary. And they're going to tell you all kinds of things about me, and I can't let you hear them because they'll make them sound so much worse than the truth. That's what they do, and I can't let them. I'd rather you remember me as the person who loves you, because I do love you, Mary. I swear to you that I do love you, and I'm capable of love because of you. You won't love me if you hear what they say. You won't love me if you know the truth. You never would have, I guess. No, I guess not. Nobody would love me. How could they? How could anyone? Now, hush, Mary. Hush now. You're my special Mary. My dear, dear Mary Laney. And I'll always love you and always remember you. And that will have to be enough. Please understand, my sweet Mary, please understand that I'm doing this out of love, and I wish it could be different. I wish it could be different. Oh, why can't it be different? Why can't they just leave me alone and give us a chance to be different and be better? There's nothing left for us now, and I can't let them hurt you or turn you against me. I won't let them destroy what we had. I won't. Now sleep, my dear, sweet princess. Sleep and carry me with you in your heart, and I'll always carry you in mine. I promise you that one day soon we'll meet again. End.
94.
Mary Laney, L-A-N-E-Y,
Books calls into his radio. I'm sitting on the floor of the SWAT team truck with my laptop open, scrolling the motor vehicle registrations in Pennsylvania, the property tax records. There are 4 Mary Laneys in the greater Pittsburgh area, I say.
Assuming it's Pittsburgh.
It has to be close, I say. Whatever he did to her, he came back here and included the transcript in his stack of papers before he vanished.
Maybe he killed her right here in his house,
says Books. Don't say that. Don't say he killed her.
It sure sounded like that, Em.
Wait, I say, looking up from the computer screen. Her age. She said her age in there, right? I think it was 37?
That sounds right.
Books flips through the passages concerning Winston Graham's beloved Mary.
Yes, 37. So she was born in 1975, or a late birthday in 1974.
I cut over to the Pennsylvania Department of Health for vital records. If she was born in Pennsylvania, she'll be... right... here! Here we go! Allentown, Pennsylvania. Mary... oh, shoot, shoot! This isn't Mary Laney, this is Marty Laney.
Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure, I say, edgy and agitated. I can tell the difference between Marty and Mary, for God's sake.
Maybe it's her brother.
Maybe, but let's keep looking. Back to the property tax records. Finding social security numbers and cross-referencing them with criminal records databases. She was once an alcoholic, so maybe she got in trouble with the law. Nothing. The 4 Mary Laneys in the greater Pittsburgh area were all law-abiding citizens. Okay, let's do taxes, I say. Department of Revenue. Department of Revenue. Tax records are chock-full of information. All I need is date of birth, for starters. She may not have been born in Pennsylvania, but she pays her taxes here. 4 Mary Laneys with 4 dates of birth pop onto my screen. DOB 62294, I say. DOB 51382. DOB 52769. DOB, I bounce off the floor of the truck. Date of birth 7/11/75. Books nods.
Is that our Mary?
Hang on. Let me check the W-2 for her employer. Please be a bar or restaurant, someplace that would hire a bartender. Yes, I call out. Her employer is listed as Ernie's Sports Bar.
That's our 37-year-old bartender.
Books grabs his radio.
This is Bookman. I need the helicopters. Mobilize HRT. We have a location.
I'm coming with you, I tell him, pushing him out of the way and jumping out of the truck before he can answer. She's still alive, I say. She has to be. 95. State Route 85 in Katanning, Pennsylvania, has been shut down for a half mile in each direction of the home belonging to Mary Laney. There is a vacant lot across the street from the house, giving the helicopters a safe and convenient landing pad. State troopers have already surrounded the house. Fire trucks idle less than 100 yards away. The hostage rescue team members spill out of one of the other helicopters and briefly huddle. This is, on its face, a rescue mission, but we can't take any chances with Winston Graham. He has managed to avoid us on more than one occasion when we had him pinned down. He has outmaneuvered us constantly. Yes, his last Graham session made it sound like he was leaving her. I promise you that one day soon we'll meet again were his last words to her. But I wouldn't put it past him to be inside that house waiting for us. Books jogs over to the HRT members and confers with them while I stand across Route 85 from the house. It is a simple two-story home, some kind of shingle siding painted sky blue with white trim and a pitched roof. It is perched on a small hill with a stone path leading to the front porch. While Pennsylvania state troopers look on with their rifles poised, two members of the HRT cross the street with a ladder and post it at the side of the house. When the time comes, they will climb it to reach the landing hanging over the front porch, allowing them to enter the second-story windows at the same time they storm the first floor. But nobody is climbing yet. I look at my watch. It's past 7 in the morning now.
"Send in Kevin," says Books.
"This is taking too long," I say. "She could be dying in there." Books nods but says nothing. "Books, she could be—"
"I don't have time for this, Emmy."
"Mary doesn't have time.
Listen to me. Who knows what he has planned for us in there? His own house burst into flames when we got close to it. I'm not sending agents into a suicide mission. We check for bombs first, then if it's clear—"
"And what if that's the window of time that she dies, Books? We could save a life and we're sitting out here following protocol."
"It's not just protocol. It's the right thing to do. You want a bunch of agents to die because I didn't take simple precautions? Their lives are my responsibility."
"She's our best chance to catch Graham." Books spins toward me.
"Emmy, if you don't shut up, I'm going to put you in handcuffs. I'm not sending in men with absolutely no idea what's inside waiting for us. Not after all the surprises he's had for us so far. Would you want to be the first person to go through that door?"
He turns and walks away from me, speaking into the radio. She's in there, dying, calling out for help, praying for a miracle that someone will find her and rescue her. You prayed for that too, didn't you, Marta? You prayed that someone would save you, but nobody came. I didn't come. I wasn't there for you. I race across Route 85 toward the house.
"Emmy, what are you doing? Stop! Emmy, stop!"
I run up the path of stones leading to the house.
"All agents stand your ground," says Books through my earpiece. "Emmy, this is a direct order. Do not enter that house."
I whip out the earpiece and run up the 3 steps to the front porch, to the front door, a simple wooden door with an old-fashioned knocker. "I'm coming, honey. I'm coming to help you." I brace myself for impact as I turn the knob. 96. I enter the house, steeling myself for a moment. But nothing comes. No explosion. No pop or blast. My eyes immediately move to the floor, a hardwood foyer in a hallway, and blood smears leading down the hallway, disappearing around the corner. "Mary Laney?" I call out as I follow the path of blood, keeping to one side of the hallway to avoid stepping in the blood and contaminating the scene. "FBI! I reach the end of the hallway by a small half-bathroom. The blood trail leads into a family room with old shag carpeting and dated furniture. The trail ends at a door. The basement. I open the door. "Mary Laney!" I call into the dark basement. I reach along the wall and find a light switch. I flick it on, but nothing happens. Nothing but consuming darkness beneath me. I pull out my iPhone and use my flashlight app and aim downward, a thin beam of light showing me the way. There are 12 wooden stairs and a staircase railing. At the bottom, there is nothing but a landing that I can see. "Mary Laney!" I call out. I take the stairs down as quickly as I can, knowing that they could be booby-trapped or set up to undermine my footing or trip me, but
having no other choice. I'm coming, Marta. I'm here and I'm going to help you. Just give me that chance. Just hang on. Please don't die. Please come back to me. I sweep my small scope of light back and forth, listening for any sounds. Mary, I say again, my voice trembling now as I reach the last step, then the basement floor. Then I hear a cough, a single soft echo somewhere to my right. I spin and shine the light haphazardly, my pulse racing. Nothing. I don't see anything but a closet and a... I jump as the beam of light lowers toward the floor. A figure. An immobile figure. Something. Someone lying prone on the floor. A woman, I think, from the long hair spilling out onto the basement floor. But where are the eyes and nose and... Oh, God, I mumble, moving closer, training the small beam of yellow light on her. Her face is bloodied and purple, her eyes swollen shut, her nose askew, her mouth a pulpy mash. I bend down beside her. Her body is rising and falling, wet, raspy breaths. I touch her shoulder and she recoils. I run the flashlight over her body, her bloody white shirt and blue jeans. The blood looks like spatter to my untrained eye. It doesn't look like she was stabbed or shot, beaten terribly about the face, but not the body. Mary, I'm with the FBI. You're safe now, sweetie. Above me, the sounds of thunderous footfalls as the cavalry arrives, the FBI sending its team in. Mary's head moves ever so slightly, some sign of acknowledgement. Do you know where he is, Mary? I ask. That's okay, I say when she doesn't respond. I rub her arm gently. We're going to get you help. Footsteps pounding down the basement stairs now. Larger beams of light from the mag lights the agents use. We need a medic, I call back. I begin to rise to show myself to the agents when Mary's hand reaches out and takes mine. I put both of my hands in hers and lower my head close to her face.
Don't leave me,
she whispers. I won't, honey. I promise, I say, my voice choking, my eyes filling with tears. I'm right here. I won't ever let anybody hurt you again. Mary begins to tremble furiously, a high-pitched whine escaping her throat. I put one arm over her back and my hand under her cheek, cradling her while HRT agents storm the basement with beams of light and an army's worth of firepower. It's going to be okay, I say with a conviction I do not feel. He can't hurt you anymore. 97. I open my eyes with a start, the noisy explosion vaporizing the moment I'm awake. The dreams have been like that lately, less about the consuming flames and more about the powerful explosion that creates them. I squint in the powerful lighting. I don't know why hospitals do that with the overhead lights. When Mary Laney opens her eyes, she'll barely be able to see. And she will open her eyes, or so the doctors say. The bandages covering her bruised face and the IV drip snaked into her arm show a damaged woman, but the doctors say there's normal brain activity, which is reassuring, I guess. Though anytime someone has to look at your brain waves, it can't be a good thing. Mary has a concussion and shattered nose. Her teeth are fine, and she doesn't appear to have suffered any other facial fractures, just deep purple bruising that leaves her with slits for eyes, a swollen mouth, and cheeks. I watch the rise and fall of her chest, listen for the soft sounds of her breathing. When she awakens, we will pump her for information. We tried already after we found her, but all she could speak was incoherent babble. She was in shock, the doctors said, traumatized. They treated her bruises and did a few tests, and then ordered at least 2 hours sleep before we could talk to her again. Meanwhile, agents are scouring Graham's house. They found tires in the back of the house that he'd been burning, and gas canisters and gas masks. That's how he forced smoke into the victim's lungs to mimic the fire's smoke. They found all sorts of surgical instruments for the torture he inflicted, and medical treatises about surgery. A search of his internet activity shows that he frequented torture porn sites and sought additional medical information. It also revealed that he'd visited the Facebook pages of many of his victims, never friending them, but just checking out their information, so he knew where they lived, where they worked, all sorts of factual data that would help pin them down before he went after them. And it's clear that he learned how to set his fires from the internet, a site that explained precisely how to rig a time-delayed explosion. He used tape to dangle a balloon down from the ceiling until it was suspended over a lit candle. The balloon was full of gasoline. Beneath the candle, he placed a pile of paper. After Graham had left, the candle's flame melted the balloon, causing the gas to splash over the flame and spread to the papers. Kaboom. By the time firefighters arrived, the string would be long incinerated, and traces of the candle would remain, leading to the conclusion that the fire was caused by a candle that fell over onto newspaper or magazines. His driver's license photo has now been shown everywhere, on every cable news station and on every online news source in the nation. Everyone in the country is seeing that photo of an overweight, nearly bald, beady-eyed man named Winston Graham. He'll look different, of course. He'll have hair and probably a mustache, change the eyebrows, wear glasses, whatever. He won't make himself obvious to anyone. But where did he go? Where can he go? We have no idea. All we know is that he withdrew more than $200,000 from his bank account, so he's got the cash to do a lot of things. The door opens, and Books walks in. He nods at me with an icy glare and looks at Mary. It's not 2 hours yet, I say.
I thought maybe she woke up on her own.
I told you I'd call you as soon as she did.
You told me a lot of things,
he says, an introductory sentence to a speech that something tells me he's rehearsed.
You told me if I took this case, you'd follow my directions, and you didn't.
I don't want to talk about that, I say.
Emmy, I gave you a direct order and you disobeyed it. You could have gotten yourself killed. You could have gotten Mary killed. You could have set off an explosion that got all of us.
But I didn't, okay, Harrison? I didn't, so shut up already. Books, still standing, lets the silence work for him. We both know what's coming next. I don't care, I say. Kick me off the case. Fire me. Whatever. I'm not going to stop looking for him.
Oh, I am taking you off this case,
Books says.
I can't fire you, but I assume Dickinson will take care of that. He's already asked for a full report about your actions. There were only about 200 sworn law enforcement officers as witnesses, and I'm not going to stand in his way. You deserve to be fired.
I put my forehead against the rail of Mary's bed, the same position I'd been in when I dozed off a moment ago.
So?
Books says. So what?
So you're off this case.
I heard you the first time.
So you have to leave.
I look up at him. I'm not leaving. I promised her I wouldn't leave her. Books gives me that look he always gives me when I'm being stubborn.
You held her hand all the way into the ambulance and to the hospital. You held her hand when the doctors were treating her, which I still can't believe they let you do. But then trying to talk you out of something is like trying to reason with a brick wall.
When she wakes up, she's going to see me standing here, Books. I'm not leaving. Get used to it.
Get used to it. Get used to it. Same old Emmy, doing whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want.
Books' eyebrows start their familiar twitch. His neck glows crimson. He'd like to drag me out of the room by my hair. And he might do just that. But he doesn't. Because at that moment, a sharp intake of air comes from Mary Laney. 98. Mary Laney leans forward in bed as she expels a violent cough, thick with phlegm and dried blood. I use the automated buttons to angle her bed upwards so she's at about 60 degrees, and then I hit the button for the nurse. We're here, Mary, I say, taking her hand and caressing it. You're in a hospital, and you're safe. Once her coughing attack abates, Mary holds completely still. Her eyes, mere slits through purple-black bruising, stare forward. She is remembering everything now. And then she lets out a low moan. Her shoulders begin to tremble and tears find their way down her swollen cheeks. He can't hurt you anymore, I say.
Is he? Did you?
She spits out words through halting breaths, through her gentle sobs.
We haven't caught him yet, says Books, but we will. We need your help to do that, Mary.
Still weeping, Mary inspects herself, looking at her arms and legs, patting her hands down her torso as if searching herself for a weapon. Then she gently brings her fingers to her face, her horribly bruised and puffy face.
I'm Special Agent Bookman, and this is Emmy Dockery, a research analyst with the FBI. I'm sorry, but we really need to talk to you right now.
After a while, Mary nods, and her body stops heaving with sobs. I hand her a tissue and she blots her face gently. Then she looks at me.
You found me,
she says.
It was you. You didn't leave me.
I take her hand and give her a soft smile. You're going to be okay.
What did he? What did Winston do? Did he kill?
I look at Books, who nods.
He's wanted for murder. A string of murders.
She takes that news badly. Judging from the last Graham session we read, where Graham talked to her while he bloodied her face, she must have had some hint that he'd done evil things.
Okay, everyone back off,
says a doctor, pushing his way into the room.
Real quick, Mary, says Books. This is important. Did he give any clue as to where he was going, or what he was doing next, anything at all?
Books holds off the doctor with a stiff arm. Mary clears her throat.
He said.
I have to insist on treating my patient, says the doctor. This is important, says Books. Go ahead, Mary, what did he say?
Mary swallows with some effort. Her eyes close.
He said, you'll never catch him,
she says.
He said, he's invisible.
99. The doctor kicks us out of the room to evaluate Mary. I pass two armed federal marshals who are guarding Mary's door and move into the hallway. We'll find him, I say. I have some—
Go home, Emmy,
Books says, passing me. I wait for him to turn back. He doesn't. I'm not going home.
Well, you're not staying here. This is for authorized personnel only. You are no longer authorized.
I start after him. He's always been a fast walker. I can help you find him, I say. This is what I do best, Books. Come on. Books reaches the elevator and pushes a button.
You're done, he says. I'm done with you. I can't command an operation when people openly disregard my direction. It undermines the entire unit. If you were an adult, you'd see that. But you're not. You're a child, Emmy. A child. And I'm done.
His hand knifes through the air.
I'm done.
I shake my head, insolent. Like a child, I suppose. I can find him. I'm your best chance. Why would you give—
Sorry.
The elevator chimes and the doors part. Books steps in and turns to me.
You're done.
The doors begin to close, along with my window of opportunity. Books blocks the doors from closing and steps back out, getting so close to me that I find myself backpedaling.
You think you can step on whomever you please and everyone has to just sit there and take it?
He hisses.
Why did you want me to run this case, Emmy? I'll tell you why,
he says.
You wanted me to run this case because you figured you could walk all over me and do whatever you wanted, right?
No, as a matter of fact, I wanted you on this case because I knew the director would listen to you, and because you're one of the best agents the Bureau—
Oh, cut the shit, okay? If nothing else, I'm entitled to your honesty. You wanted someone you could manipulate, and you knew you could do that to me.
He wags his finger in my face.
Well, guess what? You've used me for the last time.
So a killer stays on the run that much longer because you can't get over the fact that I wouldn't marry you. Books draws back, his lips parting.
Wow, you are something.
Yeah, that was over the line. I'm sorry, Books. I didn't mean that. Books works his jaw, avoiding eye contact.
If you don't leave this hospital in the next 5 minutes, I'll have you arrested.
Agent! One of the federal marshals jogs down the hallway toward us.
Ms. Laney said she's ready to talk some more.
Great, Books says. Grateful to exit this conversation.
She,
The marshal raises a shoulder in apology.
She said she wants Ms. Dockery there.
Books drops his head and shakes it. Then he casts a look of steel in my direction.
Ms. Dockery has been relieved of her duties on this case. Yes, sir, but...
The federal marshal clears his throat.
She said she'll only talk to Ms. Dockery.
With an audible groan, Books runs his fingers through his hair.
I can't help smiling. Just a bit.
Well, this is awkward,
I say. Books storms past me toward Mary's room.
Well, let's go already,
he calls back to me. 100.
He seemed so normal,
says Mary Laney, her voice still raspy. She has fresh gauze covering her nose. The bruising surrounding her eyes now has a shade of blue to go with the purple and black. I can't look at her without wanting to cry. They found a Louisville Slugger aluminum baseball bat with Mary's blood on it in her basement. That's what Graham used to strike her face repeatedly, causing it to swell up like a hideous balloon. An interesting choice Graham made there, the baseball bat. Is there a significance? I wouldn't have expected him to torture Mary like he did his other victims. He wouldn't burn her or scalp her or chisel away at the nerve centers at her knees and elbows and wrists. But why use a baseball bat? Why not just use a gun and do it quickly with one pull of the trigger?
I mean, he was kind of odd and insecure,
Mary continues.
But he seemed totally harmless. Maybe not comfortable with himself, but he lightened up the more we got to know each other. He was gentle and sweet.
She looks at us with those words. At least, I think she does, based on the turning of her head. Her eyes are so buried behind the swelling that it's hard to see them move.
I know that sounds crazy now,
she says. Not at all, Mary, I say. Winston Graham fooled a lot of people. He was masterful. He got women he'd never met who lived alone to let him into their homes. That takes a special kind of con artist. Mary scoops some ice chips into her mouth from a styrofoam cup and sucks on them.
The first time I met him, he told me he was a serial killer.
Really? I say. She doesn't know that we read about their first exchange in one of the Graham session transcripts. She doesn't know those transcripts even exist. Books said he wants to wait before telling her.
That was at the bar I work at,
she says.
He...
Mary raises a hand to her ear as if talking on the phone.
He looked like he was recording his words on this contraption. He held it up to his ear like a cell phone. I made a comment to him about it, and he seemed really interested in me after that. He told me he had killed a bunch of people. I just assumed he was kidding.
Like anybody would have, I say. Mary takes us through her several dates with Graham, dates that we already know about, but we play dumb. She doesn't hit every detail that was recounted in the Graham sessions, but generally covers the same ground. The night he skulked into the bar to observe her while in disguise.
I guess that should have been the first tip-off,
she concedes before adding.
But it was flattering. Men don't usually pay much attention to me.
Next, they met for drinks after she got off work one night. Then their Saturday night date, the week that Graham took off from his murder spree. And then lying by the fireplace, kissing and nestling together, where they first broached the topic of having a serious relationship. The conversation lasts for nearly 3 hours. Books, who is the best interviewer I've ever seen, patient, detailed, covers everything that they said and did, every emotion that Mary felt, while Mary holds my hand.
This is incredibly embarrassing,
Mary says when it's over.
You must think I'm an idiot.
I think you're special, I say. And so did he. I think you got to him, Mary. I mean, he didn't kill you, did he? He killed everyone else, and not just killed, Mary. He tortured them, brutalized them. But not you. He had every reason to kill you, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. There was something different about you.
I just got lucky,
she said.
It wasn't luck, Book says. He was hitting you with an aluminum baseball bat. It would have been easy to kill you if he'd wanted to. Believe it or not, Mary, as bad as your facial injuries are, he didn't hit you nearly as hard as he could have. Even one solid swing of that bat could have given you brain damage. I think he was hesitating.
You're kidding,
she says.
No. You see something similar with suicides. People who slit their wrists. At first, they hesitate. They can't do it. So you'll see minor, superficial cuts before they drum up the nerve to actually open a vein. They're called hesitation cuts. This is something like that.
A hesitation swing, I say.
More or less, yes, says Books. He told himself he had to kill you, but every time he swung, he pulled back. Because deep down, he couldn't kill you. He cared about you too much.
She gives a bitter laugh.
I have to say, a lot of things went through my mind while he was hitting me with that bat. But he must really care about me wasn't one of those things.
But Books is right. That's why Graham used a baseball bat and not a gun or a knife. He was still deciding up to the end whether he could actually kill her.
So, what happens now?
She asks. Books nods.
You'll spend a day or two in the hospital. We'll keep watch over you. When they discharge you, we should place you in protective custody, move you somewhere.
Mary places a hand on her chest.
You think he'll come back?
We have to consider the possibility, but don't worry. He won't know where you are. We're just being extra cautious, and we'll have someone guarding you.
Who? You mean like FBI agents?
Or federal marshals? Professionals.
Mary's head drops, deflated.
I don't want to hide. I can't hide.
Just until we catch him, I say.
You could be in danger, says Books. He may change his mind and decide he doesn't want you alive. Or he may just want you, period, and try to take you with him.
Mary shakes her head and takes a deep breath. Then she looks right at me.
I'll do it if you go with me,
she says. 101. Something is wrong. Something is wrong here. I'm in the hospital cafeteria reading through my copy of the Graham sessions once more, trying to scratch an indefinable itch. Denny and Sophie, who have joined us in Pennsylvania, are sitting with me looking through their own copies. It's not much, but right now it's all we have in terms of clues. Why did he start doing these Graham sessions just last month, I ask? Just last August. He started his murder spree in September of 2011, but he didn't start recording these transcripts until 11 months later? Denny throws a toothpick into his mouth and chews on it.
Who knows? He decided that his brilliance should be memorialized.
I shake my head. He's too methodical. He would have planned these Graham sessions right along with his killing spree. I don't think he does much of anything on a whim. We know that from his actions and from what he brags about in this diary of his. Discipline, preparation, execution. Sophie says,
So the question is, what triggered this decision? What happened in August of this year, 2012, that was different from when he began the killing spree in September 2011?
We don't know of anything traumatic in his personal life, says Denny. Graham's parents died a decade ago. He didn't have any siblings. No wife or children, no girlfriend that we know of, at least until Mary, of course. No loved ones, no relationships, not even a pet.
I think back to last August. Nothing particular stands out about his methods of killing during that time period. For my part, I was just conducting my research and sending emails to Dickinson and arguing with the Peoria Police Department in Arizona. Wait, I say, jumping in my chair, spilling coffee from Denny's styrofoam cup. Wait a second. August. That was when my dispute with the police in Arizona went public. That's when the Peoria newspaper ran that article about how I was claiming Marta's death was a homicide. And they made a point of mentioning that I worked for the FBI.
He might have read that, says Denny.
Of course he read it, I say. He kept tabs on everything, absolutely. So he reads that and he's thinking that the FBI is going to start breathing down his neck. In truth, my own agency had cast me out at that point, had rejected my theories until Books came in and helped persuade the director. But Graham wouldn't have known that. For all he knew, the FBI was about to start a nationwide investigation. It was the first time that Graham felt threatened, I say.
And he responded by writing a diary?
Asks Sophie.
Why? Just in case he got caught, he wanted to explain to the world what he did?
I make a face. That doesn't sound right. Nowadays, a serial killer like him would be glorified in the media. Even if we caught him, he'd have every news magazine and cable channel in the country wanting to give him a sounding board, wanting to run a special with an ominous title like The Mind of a Predator. You know what I think? I tap the pages of the transcripts in front of me. I think this is misdirection. I think there's a lie in these pages somewhere. Something to throw us off just in case we got too close. Why not? If the FBI were on your tail, why not leave behind a note that feeds them the wrong information?
So the question is, where is the lie in those transcripts?
Denny asks.
That's a very interesting question.
Books walks up to our table.
Something you can ponder from your secluded location with Mary Laney.
The temperature seems to drop in the cafeteria. Sophie and Denny excuse themselves. Books doesn't take a seat, so I decide to get up and stand across the table from him.
You leave tomorrow, says Books. Denny's going with you, by the way.
Okay, great. I'll keep doing my research and I'll send you emails or give you a call.
Emails will be fine, he says.
He won't even look at me. He rubs the top of the chair with both hands, then pats it presumptively.
Anyway, good luck and be—
Oh, Books, come on. I know I broke protocol out there, but it's not like I shot somebody or even personally insulted you. I was trying to help somebody. You're acting like I spit in your face. Still not making eye contact with me, Books shakes his head in bemusement.
I'm just done with you, Emmy. In every way. Go ahead and send an email if you think of anything. I'm not going to stop you from doing your research. But I don't consider you part of this investigation anymore, and I don't consider you part of anything else having to do with me. Honestly, I don't ever want to speak to you or see you again.
I draw back. I didn't realize how badly I had embarrassed him, and how raw that nerve was already.
Is that clear enough, Emmy? Do we understand each other?
I wave my hand. Fine, okay, sure. Books nods and walks away.
Books,
I say. For what it's worth, I really am sorry. He stops but doesn't turn back.
It's not worth anything,
he says.
Not anymore.
102. When I see Mary Laney the next evening, for the first time, she is wearing her own clothes, not a hospital gown. And she seems the better for it, however beaten and bruised her face may be, now complete with a gigantic splint covering her nose. All set? I ask. They're picking us up in a few minutes.
I'd feel better if I didn't look like the Elephant Man.
At least she has a sense of humor about this. I leave the room. Down at the end of the hallway, Denny Sasser is talking to another man.
Oh, Emmy, he says, pointing to the other guy. Want you to meet Jim Demetrio. Jim, this is Emmy Dockery.
Jim Demetrio is just a bit taller than me, which makes him about 5'10", a middle-aged man with a stocky frame. He's wearing a polo shirt and a baseball cap.
So this is the infamous Emmy Dockery, he says. The one who cracked the case.
I shake his hand. I wouldn't go that far.
The one who discovered there was a case in the first place, then, sure. Sure.
He smiles at me.
You've made quite a name for yourself.
Jim's retired FBI, says Denny. He worked in the Pittsburgh field office until about a year and a half ago. One of the best profilers of serial killers I know. But he decided to turn to the private sector to make a killing doing security consulting.
Nice for him. I'm still wondering why I'm shaking his hand.
He's been volunteering for the canvas.
Oh, great, thanks very much, I say. There are several square miles of thick woods in Elk County near Winston Graham's ranch, and we are tracking every inch of it looking for burial sites, hidden weapons caches, anything. We'll take volunteers if we can get them.
My pleasure, says Demetrio. Nice to get my hands dirty again.
Jim's letting us use his place in Oregon, says Denny.
Ah, okay. They're sending Mary Laney to a cabin on the coast of Oregon, a town called Cannon Beach. Apparently, it's Demetrio's place.
It's perfect, says Demetrio. I wired it for security myself. Perched on top of a hill, impossible to access except by a paved driveway with a gate.
Your witness will be completely secure.
He draws a horizontal line through the air.
Completely.
Well, thank you very much, I say.
Can I ask?
He says, leaning into me.
How'd you do it? What made you put this together?
I shrug. I don't really have time for this. But I guess this guy's loaning us his cabin and he's volunteering to boot. A little professional goodwill may be in order. The data, I answer. The patterns of the crimes. Individually, they were brilliantly disguised, but collectively, they showed a pattern.
Brilliant,
he repeats.
You think he's brilliant?
I think he's a monster, but a very smart one. Demetrio's eyes narrow.
Probably best you not think of him as a monster. He's a human being with his own reasons, however misguided you may think those reasons.
He's a monster, I say again. Demetrio blanches at my rebuke.
If you say so.
I look over at Denny. She's ready to go.
Oh, then I should leave,
Demetrio says, retreating to the elevator and punching the button.
Good seeing you, old friend. Listen, I have some business up that way in a couple of days. Maybe I'll stop by?
Sure, says Denny.
Thanks again, Jimmy.
Demetrio looks at me for a long moment.
What will this monster do next, Emmy? What's your prediction?
I wipe my right hand on my jeans as the elevator door chimes. My prediction is we're going to put him in the ground, I say. A smirk crosses Demetrio's face.
Never underestimate him,
he says, before he disappears into the elevator. 103. When we land at Portland's airport, we are welcomed by an FBI escort and a steady downfall of rain. Mary, Denny, and I deplane and hurry into one of the cars, and the driver, an FBI agent from the Pittsburgh field office named Getty, speeds us away. Mary looks out the rain-slicked window.
Are we positive nobody knows where we are?
She asks me. I look over at her. We're being very careful about that. Only the four agents guarding us, you and I, and Agent Bookman know our whereabouts.
That's it. Nobody else?
Nobody else. Try to relax. You're not good at sitting still, are you?
Oh, God, no,
she says.
My dad used to say I never stopped moving, never stopped having some task. I was like a busy bee, he said. He'd make a buzz, buzz, buzz sound when he'd walk past me.
Our vehicle pulls up to a ticket booth on our way out of the airport. Mary turns away from the window and ducks her head down. She tries to be casual about it, but there's no mistaking her fear. It's an odd contrast to see her cower like this, because she is physically impressive, a bit taller than me and muscle-toned like a competitive biker or runner. Exercise, she told me, helped her beat alcoholism, became a replacement buzz. Her hair is light brown and straight, cut simply and falling just below her ears. I have no sense of how attractive she is given her current state, the tremendous bruising and discoloration, the large splint over her nose. The bandages holding the splint in place look like a landing strip across the center of her face. The rain pelts the car as we maneuver onto the open road. I'm hoping she'll settle in, maybe even get some sleep.
Nobody else knows where we are?
She asks again.
Just the four guards and Agent Bookman and you and I?
That's it, Mary. I promise.
He wouldn't come after me anyway, right?
She looks over at me. I can't imagine he would, I say. We're just being very cautious. An SUV passes us on the left and Mary ducks down again, shielding her face. This time she catches me noticing her.
Sorry,
she says. You're making yourself crazy. I put my hand on her arm. Nobody knows you're here. I promise. We drive into Cannon Beach, Oregon under cover of nightfall as planned, moving along a narrow street not 50 yards from the Pacific Ocean. I roll down the window and take in the salty, misty air. This is no vacation, but for just a moment, it feels like one. We pass some resorts, then assorted shops and restaurants and tourist souvenir stores, all of them closed up and dark at 3 in the morning. Mary grows edgier as we near our destination. She slides down in the car so that nobody can see her from outside. Not that there's anybody outside this time of night. But it's easy for me to be rational. I'm not the one with a target on my back. Then we turn right down a road, away from the ocean and the well-lit storefronts, and drive down a narrow, winding lane until we reach a car awaiting us, with two men leaning against the vehicle. They right themselves to attention when they see us. These men, I presume, are the U.S. Marshals from Portland. Mary puts out her hand and I take it, interlocking my fingers with hers. "We're going to be safe here," I say. Suddenly, a gate that I didn't even notice swings inward. The marshals get into their car, and we follow them up a steep, twisty, paved drive until we reach the cabin. Both cars pull up on the gravel parking area to the west and shine their lights on the house, various insects dancing in and out of the light beams. The cabin is all cherry wood, a wide ranch. There is a small yard surrounding it, but then on all sides, there is darkness, a void, empty space. A drop-off, I know, though I can't see it this time of night. We are perched high on a hill. It's just like Jim Demetrio said. To reach this cabin, you'd either have to drive up the driveway into the waiting arms of federal agents or scale the side of a mountain. The U.S. Marshals leave their car and search the cabin before we enter. In our front seat, Denny and the guy driving the car, Special Agent Norm Getty, wait patiently.
"The house has updated security," says Getty. "There's a front door and a back door, each with a deadbolt. Each door chimes when it's opened, and if the alarm is set and goes off, the noise can be heard across the Pacific."
He points at the house.
"There are security cameras and motion sensors surrounding the house, another camera down by the front gate, and we can see all of it from here."
He looks back at us and shows us an iPad, a video monitor with a screen split four ways to show the different cameras.
"It's completely secure," he tells us.
"Let's get out," I say to Mary. "It's okay." I slide out on Mary's side, still holding her hand, taking in the mild, damp air, the smell of the ocean carried on a light breeze. We are indeed high up on a hill, but it feels more like an island than a mountain. The property on which we are standing is maybe a quarter acre, maybe less, most of it occupied by the cabin or the gravel parking lot. The grass surrounding the cabin is minimal, and then the drop on each side, all fenced in. I approach the fence to the east and look down into nothingness.
"There's nothing down there on any side except thick branches and wild foliage," says Agent Getty. "He'd have to scale a mountain and overcome insurmountable natural obstacles. And even if he got that far, he'd have to get over this 5-foot fence which has barbed wire. It's impossible, ladies. Impossible. The only way to this cabin is up that driveway, through us, through cameras and motion sensors that will alert us to his presence long before he reaches you."
Mary nods her head.
"It does seem safe,"
she concedes. I squeeze her hand. "Absolutely," I say, hoping to convince both of us. 104. The cabin is roomy and updated inside. There is a large living room with hardwood floors, a half bath off that room, a decent-sized kitchen with a laminated countertop, and two bedrooms in the back with a Jack and Jill bathroom between them. The room I'm in has two twin beds, for Jim Demetrio's two daughters, I assume. I don't know anything about his life, but the framed photos on the bureau show Jim at a younger age with his wife and two preteen girls, waving to the camera on a boat somewhere, and in another shot, the four of them dressed formally at some event. I'm sleeping in a room that belongs to someone else, which always makes me uneasy, unwelcome. We all meet back in the living room, which is decorated like a hunting lodge, a deer's head mounted on the wall, a bearskin rug covering the center of the room, antlers on the countertop from which coffee cups hang by their handles.
"This should work," says Denny.
The other federal officers, Getty and the two U.S. Marshals, work out their plan for the night and going forward. Two agents will be stationed in their vehicle in the gravel parking lot, one of them sleeping and one of them awake. The other vehicle will be located at the base of the driveway, again with the partners trading off sleep. Each team will have an iPad that will have all of the security cameras and motion sensors accessible. Denny hands both Mary and me a small device that looks like your basic key fob for a car remote, only it contains a single red button.
"Push the button for an emergency," he says. "We'll all get it immediately."
An emergency. The gesture is intended to reassure us, but the implication does just the opposite. We'll only need the emergency button if Winston Graham has somehow, some way, against all odds, managed to call on us. A hush falls over the room. And then a chime goes off, a loud rattle, a shifting of mechanical gears. Denny spins around. Agent Getty draws his weapon. My heart leaping, I rush for Mary and embrace her. Meanwhile, perched on the wall, a door opens on a small clock. A bird pops out and says, "Cuckoo," before disappearing again inside. It is 4 a.m.
"Jesus," says Getty, holstering his weapon.
Everyone takes a breath. The bird is no threat. Presumably, it has an alibi for the murders. But it's a reminder of how jangled our nerves are, that no matter how much we reassure ourselves of our safety, nobody is completely convinced.